Hey guys, this is Nikhil.
And Nick.
And welcome back to Informatonauts.
Alright, another edition.
So today we're going to talk about a number of interesting things.
At least we think that they're interesting.
And I think what we're going to start with is talking about a service called Fiverr, which we use to get our new logo. If you guys haven't seen it, it's kind of cool. It's like an astronaut with a bunch of letters, and I guess the letters are supposed to signify information.
Yeah, you know? It's definitely something there. I think it's a really cool logo. I definitely enjoyed it, and I mean we paid out a pretty penny for it, didn't we?
Oh yeah, a whole $5.
$5.
Now that's what the name Fiverr comes from. So basically, Fiverr is a website where you have a number of people offering services that they're good at, and they'll do a small task like make a logo or whip up a quick web design or whatever it is, and they'll do it for $5. And if you are interested in performing one of these services, you can actually have sort of like an intro thing for $5, and then you can sort of give customers a more advanced version for $10, $15, so on and so forth. But it's a great way to get people to sort of try your service.
Yeah. Now, have you provided any services on Fiverr? I'm trying to avoid using terms like performed a service or anything like that. Have you provided a service to people on Fiverr?
Well, there was one thing I tried to do earlier. I never really followed through with it because a bunch of other stuff came up and it kind of went to the back burner. But I was trying to offer a service where I use the word service.
Yes, you did.
I was trying to offer a service where I could basically send people a PDF file with like a template, and they could fill out their handwriting in that template, and I would turn their handwriting into a font. And I never followed through on that, but the script definitely exists on my computer, and the workflow definitely exists. I just haven't done it.
Yeah, if you could automate that, that'd be basically passive income.
Yeah, it would take some marketing, some outbound marketing.
But, yeah. But it's basically zero cost to you to do that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. Yeah, so Fiverr. So great little service there. Great, cool new logo. I'm really happy with it. So, and for $5, that's pretty cool. All right. Well, we wanted to do a little bit of, again, this we try and do follow-up from last time. The logo was a new thing that we really wanted to talk about. We're still waiting on approval from iTunes, so if you are listening to this and you still can't find us on your iPod, that's why Apple's being slow. One of the other things that we wanted to follow up with was to discuss an issue that if you listened to last week's episode, you noticed that Nikhil and I were sounding a little bit more manly than we normally do. That was not because we'd been pumping iron ahead of time or any sort of illegal substance. It was out of sheer stupidity, which may or may not be drug-related. No, it wasn't drug-related. But the issue was when we hooked up the microphone to the computer, I set the audio sample rate to 48 kilohertz, where GarageBand, where we record the program, only accepts 44.1, and rather than doing the rate conversion, it just inputs it at that frequency. So our voices sounded
like Barry White.
Yes, very, very white.
long story short,
and so we weren't able to quite get it back the way that we had it. So we could either get it a little bit higher than normal or a little bit lower. And so I guess you can imagine which one we chose to do. So apologies to people if that sounded odd or strange. We're still trying to figure out the audio, kind of how we're going to do this, and learning as we go. So thanks for sticking with us.
You know, I am loving this tea that I'm having right here.
Yeah, what did you pick?
It's mango. It's mango tea.
Mango. I went with I don't even remember what I went with. Some sort of one of your fancy teas, because you know we have to be classy and cool as we're sitting here, casting and enjoying our delicious tea, which I'm drinking out of a Wasatch Beers Polygamy Porter mug.
It looks like you're drinking beer.
It does look like I'm drinking beer. You know, I get that comment just about every day. And I think the first couple comments were not as a joke. I think people genuinely thought that I was just sitting there snacking on a cold one.
Well, you know, you dress like a hipster sometimes. And hipsters drink IPAs at work, right?
They do. They do indeed. There's an Instagram photo. Of course, it's Instagram. And there's an Instagram photo out of somewhere of me wearing rolled up jeans, drinking cold brew coffee out of a mason jar.
Nice.
Yeah, very nice. That photo exists.
So Seattle.
It's extremely Seattle. Anyways. But, you know, when in Rome.
So today I actually want to talk about JavaScript and CoffeeScript, really. I love CoffeeScript. I've fallen in love with CoffeeScript. It's so cool. So awesome. And it compiles to JavaScript. It's like Python-esque, but it compiles to JavaScript.
Yeah. Okay. I just want to say, I remember a couple months ago, I mentioned to you this thing of CoffeeScript that one of the faculty here, Abe Flaxman, had mentioned. Mm-hmm. And you looked at me with this look of haughty derision, just like, if I wanted to write JavaScript, I would just write JavaScript. Yep. That is exactly what you said to me.
Well, you know, I tried to write JavaScript, and you know what? It's not intuitive. To a person like me who started out with like HTML and then going to C, I have to admit I've never actually learned JavaScript or jQuery. I know enough to get things done, but I don't really know it. So there's just all kinds of, like, if you want to do a comparison, you have to use 3 equal signs instead of 2 and just all sorts of things like that. It's just, I don't know. I get more annoyed and angry when I'm programming JavaScript than I do with any other language. So
it can be quite annoying. I know I was working on some projects the other week and there was one issue I was dinking around with for 2 hours. Now, I'm even worse than you. I don't know JavaScript, I don't know jQuery, and I don't really know HTML. My programming experience has been C, like hardware C, mm-hmm. and like assembly and stuff like that. So all this other gooey crap is just an absolute mess to me. But yeah, that was an issue of like weird typos or random parentheses, because everything, you have to pipe everything into a function, right? So you grab it, your function gets passed to another function, it's passed to another function, and it's all really one line. Maybe you kind of like tab it and format it, but it's really just one giant line of code. That can get a little bit funky to work with. So how does CoffeeScript improve on that?
It just makes things, it makes the syntax pretty, let's put it that way. That's all it really does. It doesn't do much more than that. It compiles to JavaScript. And you can actually take JavaScript and compile it, or I don't know, recompile it, uncompile it, decompile it, whatever you want to say, to CoffeeScript. And it goes both ways. It's actually like, they actually have web apps out there where you can just copy and paste CoffeeScript code and it'll do it on the fly.
Now, does it support the full JavaScript syntax, or is there like restrictions on it? So how does that work if I want to pipe in? So like I've been doing a lot with MongoDB, mm-hmm. so I'm using like Monk and Mongoose. How does CoffeeScript interact with those different packages?
If it's JavaScript, you have the full functionality. That's okay. My understanding. You do not lose any functionality at all by using CoffeeScript.
Okay.
So it's just, I don't know how to explain it with an analogy, because I can't think of a good analogy right now on the fly. But
okay.
I don't want to give you a wrong one either. So, but long story short, it's just, you know, you write a .coffee file, and then you run the Node.js based coffee mm-hmm. command, and it'll compile your CoffeeScript to JavaScript, and then you can run your JavaScript as per usual.
Interesting. All right. Well, next week we're going to follow up on you, and I want a good analogy of CoffeeScript. CoffeeScript is to JavaScript as...
For sure. Hold okay. me to it.
Yeah. We'll hold you to that. That's interesting. And I'm going to have to look into this, because it sounds nice. It sounds appealing. I've been using... I've been playing around with... Have you heard of the Mean Stack?
No, teach me.
So you're familiar with the LAMP stack, Linux, Apache, MySQL, and PHP, the like the 90s like web development package where you could spin stuff up in like zero time. Mm-hmm. So now I've been hearing about the Mean stack, which is MongoDB, Express, AngularJS, ExpressJS, AngularJS, and then Node.js.
All right, so very quickly, do you know off the top of your head what Angular, Express, and Node.js do?
Yes.
Okay.
So ExpressJS is a framework for writing web apps. So Node.js is the engine that runs on top of V8 and the JavaScript engine. Express takes creates a kind of a blank skeleton or a framework for you writing a web app. So it understands that you'll have configuration files, you have style sheets, you'll have core, you might have jQuery functions and just core JavaScript. You might have other stuff that gets plugged in with that, other resources. And so it basically partitions all of that stuff off for you, links in the correct web packages or packages to do the calls and responses, and for writing like APIs and things like that. So it gives you a nice kind of smooth package syntax to work with that. It also plugs in with HTML templating engines. So I use Jade, which is nice because it gets rid of a lot. It gets rid of basically all the closing brackets of HTML. So similar function, similar mindset. Things are still, you know, div, div dot, that type of stuff. But now you don't close things off. You don't worry with like weird quotation marks and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you define where you are based on where you're tabbed or spaced. Don't mix tabs and spaces, where it's like Python in that. And so you space and you line things up within this Jade file, and it gets compiled to HTML. So similar to CoffeeScript, although I think it's much more directly, when you look at it, the format is very much HTML, just with some of the superfluous endings kind of ripped off. And then AngularJS is a system for working, for doing client-server data manipulation and things like that. And I just started working with it last night, and it's actually quite nice. So normally I'm a little bit of a curmudgeon. When I come across something new, I'm not always super enthused or excited. I'm like, this thing kind of sucks. But actually, surprisingly, I liked AngularJS.
So I know that you just started to work with it last night, like you just said, but have you been able to build anything cool with it yet?
Yeah, well, okay, let's get rid of the cool modifier. Have I been able to build anything with it yet? I have indeed. There's actually a really great tutorial on IBM's website that is building a polling app, and basically like a voting app.
Hold up a second. So IBM has a tutorial now on how to do this?
IBM has a tutorial on all open source software.
As I recall, wasn't IBM and like didn't Oracle also poo-poo like MongoDB and a bunch of other those like CouchDB type databases and stuff back in the day?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure that they did.
And now they're adapted.
Absolutely. I think they're adapted in fits and starts. I think this is an easy way for them to kind of say, here, we'll reach out. Look, we're real developers. Of course, if you really want to be cool, then you'll jump right back into our, you know, onto our platform. But
Of course.
But it's a quite well-written tutorial. It goes through, it uses kind of all the basics. So like I said, Mongo and Express and all that stuff. Uses Socket.io and Eclipse to develop and write your code in and stuff. And Eclipse has a really great plugin called NodeClips that is actually, it's quite nice. And so I built this app in it. It's not super complex, but it's got lots of pieces that go into it. And I really enjoyed working with it. Now, I know you use Sublime, right?
I do use Sublime Text, yeah.
How do you like that?
I like it. I mean, I haven't used any of the advanced features, or I don't use it very often. I just today got a plugin that does syntax highlighting for CoffeeScript.
Nice.
And that looks like it works quite well, but you know, I just started using it. Yeah. So
now NodeClips has native support for CoffeeScript.
Yeah, I think I might want to switch over to NodeClips.
Yeah. Now I don't usually use IDEs. In general, I'm writing stuff in Vim or MacVim. Do you use MacVim?
Of course I do.
MacVim is
standard, man.
It is. It's quite, I really do like Vim. I use it all the time. I really like it. But I've been trying to work with this, especially as one of the things with Express is that you get lots of files, you get this sort of project, quote unquote, bloat, where all of a sudden you have all these pieces. Whereas before you could probably just write a simple app in one piece of JavaScript, one piece of HTML. It forces you in a sense to think about things in pieces. So all of a sudden you've got multiple folders, multiple files that you're kind of managing and working with, which is fine, but it makes it a bit more difficult to be doing something with Vim. And so Eclipse has been quite nice in letting me kind of open that up. It runs it within its own terminal, so I can start and restart the server, watch the debugger and things like that. So it's been pretty nice. One of the issues that I've been having, though, is trying to figure out, there's so much, JavaScript is so big, Node.js is such an active and vibrant community, it's really, really difficult to figure out where to dive in.
Yeah,
so there's sure. So Angular, there's also like Backbone. There's a couple other of those kind of MVC frameworks. And it's difficult to figure. I mean, you can even use like jQuery or JS Render and all this stuff. It's difficult in a lot of ways to sit down and try and like figure out, where do I even start? Where do I put my time in? A lot of what I do involves playing around with a little different pieces of technology. And as such, I end up with a little bit of exposure, no expertise in basically anything.
Well, I think that's because right now things are rigged in a way to just get things done. I think it all comes down to just getting things done.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time, like, I feel like I don't actually need to know. I've gotten away with not knowing JavaScript for a long, long time. And that's just because I might find out what Node.js or, you know, Ember.js is capable of, their functionality, and kind of come up with the workflow before I actually build anything. So then I kind of know that, okay, this library has this function, and I can use this function to connect to that function somewhere else, and I can plug that back in to fulfill the criteria for my application. And then I'll just build it, because there are tons of great tutorials out there on the internet, and you can build something without having to know anything.
Yeah, which is what I've been.
It's how we've all been operating.
Yeah, and it's definitely a great way to do it. There's a little bit of again the added complexity of Angular has its own kind of built-in minimum complexity, as is Express, so that can get a little bit funky to try and mess with. But like you were saying, I'm trying to figure out, you know, what tools do I use? I want to map out my workflow or map up the project flow. What do I plug in where? There's so many options for each of those individual steps that at times it can be really overwhelming. And I'm trying to shrink my toolkit down, where I'd like to focus on 4 core languages, you know, a couple core libraries, where maybe I'm branching out on other projects, but in reality I'm becoming really well familiar and agile with those specific technologies. Maybe they're not totally ideal, but again, with the stuff that we're doing, we're not dealing with scale. We're not dealing with ridiculously tight deadlines or super complexity, where if maybe Angular isn't super great at this sort of templating or whatever, that's okay. We can work around that.
Right, it's good enough.
Yeah.
And you can sort of validate your idea and get things to work and just get it done. And then kind of see if that is picking up. And if it does pick up, then you can kind of cross that bridge when you get to it and scale up as you need to or change your underlying technology.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great way to approach things, I think, Nick.
Yeah. So I think, again, this quote-unquote mean stack, I think, is a great place to look at and try and get started with. And if you can figure out how to use each of these components, there's a lot that there's not a lot that you can't do with that. So now you've been doing a bunch of stuff with workflows and some other things as well. What have you been up to?
Yeah, so in general, I use the Getting Things Done workflow.
Of course.
You know, from David Allen.
Of course.
That was brilliant. So I've experimented with a ton of different ways of doing it. I used Weave on my iPhone for a while because it was free. I bought OmniFocus,
mm-hmm.
which is about $20 on the iPhone,
mm-hmm.
And I forget, $60, $100, whatever it is on the Mac. And you know, I integrated all of them together, and I was using all these high tech apps. But then I kind of thought, what if I just try to go back to pen and paper? Like, what would that? Why did they switch in the first place? Is it because I actually needed to, or is it because tech is just kind of fancier and I wanted to look cool? So my little experiment was to go back and try to use pen and paper for my to-do lists. And in general, it works out better. Like, you know, for me, in my lifestyle, I think it's nice to be able to have a small piece of paper where I write down what I need to do, or a little diagram. And I think that's it allows me to be expressive. And with these to-do list apps, you don't really, because they are looking for structured fields, you can't really be as expressive in what you want to write down. So there's kind of a pro and con thing you have to balance there. And on top of that, I've noticed that, you know, with the computer to-do list, it might be easy to like have a task in one list and then kind of drag and drop it to a different list. But in real life, when you have your written list, you have to kind of scratch things out and then rewrite it, which is kind of annoying. It does get to be kind of old. But for the most part, you really have to, because of my at least innate laziness, I have to actually figure out, okay, do I want to rewrite this? Is this really important? And I kind of have to, you know, really enforce my 80-20 rule kind of a thing. So in many ways, it's kind of been more productive to go back to paper and pencil for me.
Interesting. I've been flirting with paper off and on. I have a few additional constraints. One is that my handwriting is at a level seldom seen by humankind. In fact, if I had not come to grad school, I was considering a career mentoring doctors in crappy handwriting in order to continue to obfuscate. That's how That's how exceptional my handwriting is.
Or reviving the field of stenography.
Yes, just kind of, yeah, squirreling on the paper, right?
Yep.
It's more, my writing is more abstract than most individuals. So actually, though, you know, I'll just decide that is actually a difficulty sometimes going back and rereading what I've been writing, which is a bit of a pain. But I know lots of people have been talking about the benefits of paper and things like that. An issue for me with the computing, with electronic stuff, is I hop platforms so much that it's difficult for me to find a task manager that goes with me wherever I go. So I have been using, I use on my Mac, I use Things from Cultured Code, which I love. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And when I have my iPhone, I would sync it with my iPhone, and it was absolutely amazing. In fact, that one app was, when I switched to the Windows platform, that was the one app that almost kept me from not switching. I liked it so much. It was so easy to use, and I felt like I was so much more productive with it. Now I don't have that anymore. So I've been looking at using Wunderlist, but I haven't really given it a full go yet. Part of it's because I have all of my to-dos, and I keep lists, like David Allen says, I keep lists of all sorts of things, books to read, stuff to look up, stuff to go buy at the store, and I would have to move all of that to Wunderlist. So they're supposed to open up an API soon, in which case I'll, you know, scrape together a JavaScript app or something to pull out of the Things as a SQLite database. So pull out of the SQLite and then shove it up into the cloud. But
right.
I haven't gotten there yet. What I have been doing is on and off, again, as most of my habits are, they're on and off, carrying a legal pad with me and using that for research ideas or papers that I'm working on or something like that. So that way when I'm waiting for the bus or on the bus, although with the streets here in Seattle, it's kind of difficult to write on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
But that way, wherever I am, I can sit down and start writing stuff out. And I don't have to just sit there and wait until I can open up a computer or something like that.
Nah, cool. But did you, I don't know if you mentioned or not, do you use Getting Things Done? Do you use that platform?
I have a modified. I'm like a pseudo-orthodox.
Okay.
Getting Things Done. Or I should probably implement more. I've been meaning to go back and actually read through the book again and re-up my workflow. But I try and do the same, you know, a similar type of methodology. So.
Okay. It was actually a pretty cool flowchart that David Allen made, and I think it's available online somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, like sort of the proof is available for free, but if you want the actual poster, which is a big poster,
yeah,
you have to pay like $20-$30 for it. But, you know, if you need to be reminded constantly about getting things done, then it might be a worthy investment.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, you can check out that proof, like JPEG image, and you can get an idea, a very quick 2-minute overview, refresher, so to speak, of GTD.
Yeah.
So
I'm pretty good at keeping, again, his central principle of all these things that our brain is trying to remember is churning up our mental capacity for other things, and our brain is tracking them. Even if we're not remembering them, our brain is still kind of tracking them.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Which I think is absolutely true. So I'm pretty good at getting stuff out onto a list. So my to-do lists are very extensive, and I've got, with Things, it makes it super easy to schedule stuff for different days, be reminded. So my to-dos are very automated, and I've got assignments and deadlines and things that I want all added up into there. And so that's been really useful. So I'm pretty happy on that end, but there's a lot of the rest of my workflow I think that could benefit from paper. Now, as you've been experimenting with paper, have you been getting into, now this would be like super hipster, getting into like different kinds of paper and notebooks or pens and pencils or anything like that?
Have you heard of Merlin Mann?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Merlin Mann had this, I think it was more of a parody, but he got a bunch of note cards and he got a little binder clip and he clipped them together and he called that the hipster PDA.
I've seen that. That is actually a really brilliant thing.
I've used it and it does work in a weird way. It's hilarious. And I actually got my girlfriend to use it and she's been using it. She has no idea it's called a hipster PDA. She has no idea who Merlin Mann is, and she's just like, this is kind of useful, like this kind of just works.
Mm-hmm.
And I was laughing on the inside.
Yes.
But it really is useful, and the fact that it started out as a joke but that it actually does work is just brilliant to me. I love Merlin Mann. That guy's awesome.
Yeah. Now, have you, since I know a lot of people will carry like field notes or moleskins or something like that, and
mm-hmm.
I have some friends that I have one friend in particular that's very into different pens and pencils and stuff like that. And have you gotten to that level of nerdery yet?
No, I haven't. If anything, I'm considering investing in that Evernote notebook.
Oh, yeah,
the kind that you can kind of scan into your computer and have little stickers to denote, you know, different things in your day.
Yeah.
Because for my understanding is that you can actually take, after you scan that image in of your notebook, you can actually search it through Evernote. It'll take your handwriting and convert it to a searchable text. So that's really cool.
Yeah. I've seen some people, I saw some a web post by somebody who had a lot of those like field notebooks and stuff, and they used, there's a couple open source products, one's called like DocuSys or something like that, or maybe that's a company. Anyways, he took all his notebooks and photographed, took an image of all the pictures, or took a picture of all the pages using a, you know, a high-end DSLR, and then took those in, and he didn't do the next step of then doing the image recognition, but having all the different, he would time and date stamp all the images, put them up in Dropbox, and then he had everything with him. So I've thought about doing something like with the Evernote notebook. So
have you ever heard of an app called Pencil?
No, there's literally an app called Pencil.
There's an app called Pencil. So this might seem ironic to you.
It does.
So what happens is on the iPad, there's an app called Pencil, and there's a different app that goes with it called Paper, I think. I think it's called Paper. Don't quote me on that, but it's an app where you can use this pencil that you buy, and it's like a real pencil that you hold in your hand, and you can actually draw and write on your iPad like you would write on a piece of paper, except it's digital. So in a weird way, we're kind of coming back full circle to paper and pencil anyway, except it's just a more high-tech solution, a more high-tech means of doing it.
Everything old is new again.
Yeah.
So, well, I have a new pencil that I have fallen in love with.
Okay.
It is a Uniball Kurutoga. One of the things that's interesting about this pencil is I actually did research pencils, and this one kept coming up. This is the U.S. version, so it's made of plastic. The Japanese version is like $15 a pop, but it's all metal.
Okay.
There's one in my future, but it's a very distant future. One of the things that's interesting is the type of lead that they use is like, they call it black diamond or something, and it really is quite rigid, much stronger than like traditional like graphite lead. So I don't snap it as much. I tend to put a lot of pressure on when I write, and I'm always snapping leads, and I don't do that with this pencil. The other thing is that it has a little mechanical system in it that whenever you release take the pressure off the tip of the pencil, it rotates the lead so that it's always keeping the sharp point of the lead down.
Wow.
And it actually works. Okay. Surprisingly.
And it's a pencil, not a pen.
It's a pencil, yeah. And it's not, I think I paid $4 or $5 for this one, but I really like it. It's very comfortable to write with, very easy to use. And then of course I use my Statler erasers, my Mars plastic, like all good engineers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much more enjoyable to write with. And it's much, especially for me with having such terrible handwriting, without it getting that like weird smudgy flat color, I can actually read my handwriting a lot better.
You know, one of the guys I rock climb with, he was showing me his pen. And this pen, it was a Uniball pen, I think. And apparently you could write with it upside down.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You could write with it underwater, and it wouldn't smudge. Like, it dries very, very quickly. So that was some kind of really expensive pen that he got. And he got them in a pack of two or three. But I think the pack was like $50. And I don't know what it's called.
Was it the Fisher Space Pen?
It could be. That could be it. But it was a pretty, pretty cool pen. And I just didn't feel like I needed any of those functions, so it was cool, but I wasn't like swayed to buy it myself.
I don't tend to write in a vacuum very often.
I know,
or anything like that. But yeah. Anyways, but I know people that move to an analog workflow, it's easy to get sucked in. I mean, it's like it's geeks and it's people that like toys. And now instead of having toys of dozens and dozens of to-do apps, they now have different pencils and papers and stuff. Although using this, I just filled up a legal pad with that like really cheap yellow paper, and it really like it like gets like weird like coating on my hand or whatever. I was like, you know what, this is terrible. Like, I can see getting a real, like, putting a little bit of money into a better notebook or something like that. But,
you know, I'm kind of thinking now, going back to the idea of a paper and pen workflow, why it might actually be, why I find it nicer. And I think it's because a to-do list app, it forces you to kind of make a finalized list of things. Whereas when I'm using pen and paper, I can actually like use it as like a scratch pad, and I can kind of jot my ideas down and scratch things out and draw diagrams, and it's kind of more of a work in progress. And then I'll get to a point where, okay, this is a finalized list, and then I can transfer it over to a different piece of paper or input it into a to-do list app. But I need that process of kind of like messing with things in my head and putting it on paper and scratching things out and drawing arrows and circles. And that's where I think a lot of the value is.
Interesting.
Yeah.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, that definitely resonates with me. I don't know if I would necessarily say putting something on a computer makes it finite because I can just easily hit delete, but you definitely, it's much more difficult to commit an unfinished thought onto, you create a new to-do, and it's very difficult to, in my mind, to make that jump to write down to say something like, find socks, ? For an event next week, mm-hmm. or what type of library should I use to solve this problem? Where's my memory leak? Like, those types of things are more difficult to write, to make that translation into the digital world, whereas it's much easier on a piece of paper, right? Where's this memory? Those types of things. The scratch pad idea definitely makes sense to me.
Maybe some context would kind of give you some more of a better understanding of where I'm coming from. Whenever I write things down, I kind of write down like the outcome I want, and then I write down like why I'm doing it, like why I want that outcome, and then I write down like several different ways to get there. Because, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat, right?
Seven.
Nine, maybe? One for each life? I don't know. But, you know, there are several different ways to get there. So maybe if I want to build a web app, maybe I can use Ruby on Rails. Maybe I can use JavaScript. Maybe I can use just plain HTML. Maybe I can use whatever, you know. I can use Python and Flask. There's a whole bunch of ways to get there, right? And there is no one right way. So, but the goal is to get that outcome, is just to get things done. So I think by sort of fooling around on pencil and paper, I can kind of jot down ideas and then figure out, okay, here's what I'm doing, here's why I'm doing it, and here's how I'm going to try to do it this time around. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So I need that process personally. And there's a lot that goes into it. So
I think there's a lot of people that need that process. But first, do you ever watch Parks and Rec on NBC?
Not regularly.
Set in Indiana, Parks and Rec department in
somewhere in Indiana. Oh, I know that show. Yeah, for sure.
But there's one episode where they had to go to the animal control department because it's like falling apart and it's run by these two potheads or whatever. They're talking about different ways to fix it, and Leslie, the main character, goes, "There's more than one way to skin a cat," and the employee goes, "There's seven. There's seven ways to skin a cat."
All right, that's where he came from. Okay.
Yeah, so that was that, but. There's another story about pen and paper, since this is a tech podcast, so obviously we should talk about this. Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase, mm-hmm. is notorious for his 8 and 11 sheets of paper. That he has always with him a couple and a half by 11 sheets that he is always writing things down on. They're just like covered front to back, scribbled. And he remembers things, and he'll pull it out and flip around and be like, "Oh, remember when we talked about last week about this one number or something like that?" Was like, he'll pull those things out, and so people they fear the sheets, but everything, it's all, you know, they'll go into a meeting, everyone's iPads and stuff, and he's sitting there pen and paper.
You know, there have been psych studies that when you write something down, like by hand, it is more likely to be committed to memory. And I wonder if it's the same thing when you type something. Like, I feel like I can type a piece of code and I will not know it. But if I write it down by hand, I have a remarkably better chance of remembering that thing. And I think that's why people mess up in interviews so often. Like, have you ever had that interview where you kind of go in and the guy's like, "Write this code on the board," and you're like, I know how to do this, I just can't do it right now. And it's because we just aren't used to it. We don't have that muscle memory.
Yeah, where's this? It's like, wait, where's Stack Overflow? How am I supposed to write this code now?
Exactly.
No, absolutely. Well, I think there is a disconnect between writing things down is very like ingrained in the motion of remembering. Typing to some extent, but less. So when I was in elementary school, I was terrible at spelling. I'm still not great now, but I was like horrifically bad. So every night I would have to come home and do my spelling words. And I hated writing because it was slow and I couldn't read. So I had a Word document and I would write and I would type them like 20 times or whatever, each word. And that helped. My spelling grades went up quite a bit. I mean, I wasn't A's and everything, but I went from being bottom tier to, you know, being definitely passable. Had I written it down, I probably would have done a little bit better. But that's what I needed to. I needed that continuous repetition and process. And so the process of typing, I think, does aid in. It's the tactile. It's the doing. And I think especially for people that learn by doing, that's a part of it.
For sure. Yeah.
Now, do you think that your paper methods help you with your attention or your focus or anything like that?
Not necessarily. But you know, I think. Actually, I think maybe I briefly touched on the attention economy last week.
Mm-hmm.
But right now I'm working on visualizations, yeah. Right? So that this also might be why I'm finding pen and paper nicer, because I can actually draw a little circle or a little pie chart and go, this is what you're not supposed to do, you know? And a lot of times I've actually gone through a couple of studies now about attention. And a few of them talk about what you should and shouldn't do in visuals, what you should and shouldn't do on web pages, what you should and shouldn't do in writing, and like, you know, writing a sales copy or a marketing copy. And it's really interesting. And what they also talk about is how attention is finite. You only have a certain amount of it, just like willpower. And with all these different apps and things vying for your attention, we kind of have this product-induced ADHD, you know? That might be why it's been over-diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's just the way that marketing and sales has been operating for the past few years.
Yeah, well, it's also our ability to multitask has increased exponentially. I can do more than one thing at any one given time, and I'm largely expected to do more than one thing at any given time. So my mind is oriented towards, I'm going to rapidly switch between contexts. And so it's difficult to sit and focus on one thing for a very long time. So I think, yeah, I think we are diagnosing ADD, ADHD more. I think it's partially one that we, it's like a detection bias. We're much more aware of it. Mm-hmm. Two, I think a lot more of it is, like you said, induced as opposed to just being, some people have it with chemical imbalances and things like that. I don't know if that number is necessarily rising, but I think that we're detecting it more and we're inducing it more in the population, definitely. So what does one do to increase their attention span or to conserve their finite amount of attention?
Single task. And say no to a lot of things and just have tunnel vision. You need to, I mean, this kind of connects back to your to-do list in a way. Like you write your to-do and you do whatever you have to do to get it done. You isolate yourself. And when you need to do multitask sort of things, try and delegate it or try to automate it. I've been using IFTTT.
What is IFTTT?
Okay, so it stands for if this, then that. And you can automate a lot of cool things. So whenever, if you guys are following me on Twitter, you'll notice that I tweet all the time. And in reality, I don't. What I've ended up doing is just taking a lot of RSS feeds, which have links that I think are interesting, and I connect that to IFTTT. So whenever there's a new RSS feed posting, then it'll post it to my Twitter feed. So half the time, I have no idea what I'm even posting on Twitter. But
because I remember I asked you about it. I was like, hey, what did you think of this article? Like, oh, I didn't read it.
Yeah.
Now that's clever. I use it for, I do that for a couple sites that publish stuff that I pretty much continuously, like 98% of what they publish I'll want to read. So I use IFTTT to pull it into Pocket so I can read it on the bus.
Right.
That's about the extent that I use. I don't automate probably nearly as much as I should. I'm a little bit old school in that I like hands-on. I manually update all my apps and OS and everything. And I read the bug. I read pain. Like the change logs and stuff.
I feel pain. Physical
pain.
Yeah,
that's what I do. I mean, obviously Chrome auto-updates and stuff, but even I had to update Flash the other day because it notified me and it didn't do it in the background. And so I'm not nearly as automated as most people. But
speaking of Pocket, you mentioned that you're in the top, 5%?
Readers? I was. So last September 2013, I got my little Nexus tablet and got Pocket, started reading it. In December, I had made it to the top 10% of Pocket readers. Worldwide or whatever.
Worldwide. Not even just in Seattle. Worldwide.
No, I got the top 10% of Pocket readers. So that was a bit of an accomplishment. I felt quite nice. So I'm going for top 1% this year. Not attention. I mean, I read it on the bus. I'm on the bus for about 25 or 30 minutes to and from campus or to and from the office. So I get quite a bit of time to sit and read. I don't read, I don't use Pocket. I pretty much just use Pocket on the bus. I don't use it much like at home. But so I've got, you know, between half an hour a day of reading that I'm just reading on Pocket usually. So
yeah, my commute's about 20 minutes. So each way, right? It doesn't matter if I'm going to campus or if I'm going to my office in South Lake Union. It's the same commute time. And I tend to listen to podcasts like this one, or to listen
to this one's awesome.
Yeah, listen to NPR or read a book or whatever. And I do get a fair amount of reading done. It's amazing. If you just sort of take your commute time and make that your reading time, you'll actually go through a fair number of books in the course of a given year. So that's a very smart way to do things.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. For me, again, I usually use bus commute is usually Pocket reading, so catching up on stuff that's on the internet or long form. Have you seen Long Reads?
No.
It's a great website that curates long form content from around the web, primarily New York Times and Harper's, that kind of Pacific Monthly, and they categorize different technology or politics or human interest. It's not very broad amount like content. Sometimes they'll branch off into one area, business or history or something like that. But in general, it's human interest stories or kind of obscure pieces of history. The one that I read this week was on the use of Monopoly during World War II to smuggle escape tools into German POW camps.
Wow.
Yes. So that was it. Actually, it wasn't that great of an article, but it was interesting. So yeah, definitely. I'll link to it. It was kind of interesting. So, and they give you a number of words about how long it'll take to read it. So shall we move on to this other paper that I was reading today?
Let's. Okay. Absolutely.
So this paper is, let me pull it up here. It's a little bit old. It came out May August of last year. It is called War, Space, and the Evolution of Old World Complex Societies.
Okay, let's hear it.
So this is a history piece positing an idea called cleodynamics, which is the fact, one of the principles is that the primary driver of human civilization is conflict and war, and based on taking the geographic factors, military technology, and the evolution of what they call ultra-social norms, which are big, complex social ideas and institutions that are difficult to sustain in small societies, but quite critical to large societies. One would be religion. Another one would be supporting like cooperation and support within multi-ethnic groups and stuff like that. Based on taking those things together and adding in stuff like elevation and type of land, that they think that they can predict the rise and fall of empires.
Okay.
So they built this model, ran through it, and they were able. They primarily looked at ancient world civilizations. So you could think Romans and the Romans and the Persians or the Han people. And they were able to predict 65% of variance in the data.
Okay, well that's not, I mean, that's a little bit more than taking a shot in the dark, 50-50.
Well, what's interesting is that if you took away the effect of diffusing military technologies, it was only able to explain 16% of the variance in the model. So not only do they have a model that has some accuracy in predicting the rise and fall of empires, but that it validates in a way their theory that war is the primary driver between societal evolution.
You know, I'm thinking that there's going to be a lot more to it than just war. And the reason why is because all those places, they have different cultures, and they were in different times, there were different empires that were around with different leaders who had different desires. Like, you know, if Alexander wanted to take over the world, and then you had somebody else who didn't really care so much. So this kind of, in a way, it resonates with me in terms of genetics, because I feel like with genomics, you know, we're looking at the genome now, and we have our DNA, which adds to our environment, and that gives us our physical traits. But, and we might, you know, have technology to look at our DNA right now, and we might understand our DNA. We might understand the physical traits, but that whole confounder of the environment, like, we don't understand that quite yet. And it's hard to measure and it's hard to understand. And I think this is sort of a similar thing. In this model, what they have right now is equivalent to DNA. And there's this entire environment variable that they're kind of missing. But then they also have the output or the result, the downfall of society.
Now, they have a little bit of taken strictly the term environment. They definitely have part of that. So they connect with, they do factor in things like elevation and terrain type. They focus on the steps and the first place, which, because the idea is that the first factor was historically one of the most important factors determining the intensity of Afro-Eurasian warfare was proximity to grasslands inhabited by horse-riding nomads. And so they, looking at that, looking at the historical evidence that they were able to compile, their model also like predicted that rise within that area as well. And then, of course, then it changes, and the area of elevation matters because elevated areas are easier to defend, more difficult to conquer, but they support fewer people. And so they did include a lot of this kind of stuff, and were able to get a moderately close fit to the actual data.
You know, to me, off the bat, it seems like I just don't know why they would choose those indicators like to be part of their function for the model, because, I mean, I would guess just off the bat that the size of the population of the country at hand is important, the size of their army is important, the state of their economy, if the economy is doing well or not doing so well, the politics. I would think those would be like the biggest factors in whether or not a nation is going to thrive or fall.
Now, the politics one is very true. The others are less so. So you can look at the Western European colonialization,
mm-hmm.
where you have a very small group of people that overtook a very large populace, even though a larger standing army, more indigenous people, and severely restricted supply routes. They obviously had much better military weapons. Or you could look at the Chinese Empire had a massive start. Their GDP production was just way off the charts compared to what Europe was. In fact, there was a comment in a book I was reading a couple months ago where basically compared to the seat of, I can't remember what it was, what the name of it was, like Peking or whatever was the capital of China, quote unquote, at the time. London was a backwater town. It was basically non-existent in like the 1500s. Mm-hmm. And then by the 1800s, you've just got tremendous increases in society and cultural economic output and those kinds of things. So their point is that when you look at it, that there's a very strong thesis for that military or war is a driving metric. And by creating this model and focusing it primarily on the distribution or the diffusion of resource, military resources, but they can explain a large amount of historical cultural growth. A couple things that I take issue with is, one, that this writes the history of the world as a history of empire, which is a model that you can use, but it's also not super significant.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot else that happened in the world that wasn't directly related to an empire or a civilization. If you read, what's his name? The Clash of Civilizations, Huntington, if you read Huntington stuff. So you can, there's a lot that doesn't take into account. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, or there's just a lot of history that's unaccounted for if you are primarily looking at the great quote-unquote historical empires. But what I thought this paper was really interesting, and one of the reasons why I wanted to include it, was the fact that they took what has primarily been a verbal explanation of historical development or these historical theories, and they created one theory, one model, and tested it to see how does it actually line up, how does it actually fit the data.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't fit perfectly, but there's a lot, but it fits. And it fits a lot, and it has some correlation. But the fact was that they are interestingly able to go back and create a probabilistic model for the wealth and growth of nations, which is really interesting to me.
Right.
It's also interesting that these three people, there's one at Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at University of Connecticut, Center for Ecology and Conservation at University of Exeter, and Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology and Department of Mathematics at the University of Tennessee. Not historians.
Right.
Not historians, biologists and evolutionary biologists or environmental scientists. That's a really interesting combination to be writing a paper like this. So what is when you look at that, you'd say, wow, that's kind of interesting that historical development evolution would be of interest to biologists and mathematicians.
Mm-hmm.
Not something that I would have normally have associated, put into their interest group or whatever. So
right. Yeah, it's an interesting paper. It definitely seems like it's something that those faculty members did for fun. Like, I don't know if it was, like, it looks like it was published in PNAS.
PNAS, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Right. Is that an open source or open?
This one is. I don't think all of PNAS.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I could be wrong. I don't know if it's fully open, if it's open access or not. But this paper is. And there's also a 30-page supplemental that they published along with all of their calculations and assumptions and things. So I didn't get enough chance to like really dig through all of the way they set up their model, but it seems to me that they did a really laudable job at being open about it, of saying, this is what we did. So you can take issue with it, but at least this is what we did. Right. Here's the assumptions we're working with.
And that's the way science is done. That's perfect.
So it's very exciting.
And at least we know that the model's not overfit. I mean, 65% is very realistic for a model.
Yeah. Especially a model that deals with thousands of years of human evolution and development. And there's a movie too. So they have a little video you can watch there, and we'll link to it. You can watch the rise and fall of nations.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm wanting to move on and talk about GMO apples. Is that cool with you?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so there was on NPR, there was a article, I think it was a week or two ago, about how there were scientists in Canada who developed an apple that doesn't brown. So when you cut an apple, you know, usually if you look at it, after a few minutes, it starts to brown. And in Canada, it doesn't happen anymore. Or apparently it won't happen anymore because they have these apples that don't brown. So that ended up being, it kind of launched this debate again about GMO foods and organic foods. So I know that it's been deemed to be safe thus far. And even though it's been deemed to be safe, lots of people just feel like it's an unnatural food, that apples are supposed to brown. But at the same time, you have, you know, little picky kids who don't want to eat browned apples, or just foods that, you know, consumers demand fresh-looking food, and then they want them to be actually fresh and not just look fresh, kind of a thing.
Yeah. Now, what causes apples to brown? It's exposure to air, right?
Yeah, oxidization, I think.
Okay, so that is the process of, that's decomposition, correct?
It is, but it's mostly an enzyme that makes it brown. Really what they do is they found a copy of the gene in the apple genome that makes this enzyme that makes apples brown, and they added a second copy, and for some reason or another, it deactivates the browning enzyme. So it'll still rot the way an apple normally rots. It's not going to make it like this immortal, invincible apple, but it just will not secrete that enzyme, which will brown the apple when it's exposed to the air. So it'll just look like it's been cut fresh.
Interesting, because I know that there's been some work on, a big thing is food spoilage. Isn't it something like 30% of the world's food supply is like spoils in transit? Something like that?
Yeah, I've heard that metric too.
So I know that there's been a lot of work on delaying decomposition and spoilage. So if this apple didn't brown because it just, or did, or it's over a much slower time, that could be immensely valuable as opposed to having just kind of an immediate aesthetic or, kids eating vegetables is a really important thing. So there's definitely value in that. This reminds me of a paper that I saw a couple months ago in Informa Healthcare, I think is what it was, Journal of Healthcare Research or something, where it came out of the Italy, I believe, and it was a 10-year meta-analysis of as many papers as they could find on this issue on GMOs and things like that. And basically what they found was that there's almost no evidence of GMOs being harmful.
Well, of course.
Yeah. But they actually took it a step further and they said, okay, but if we look at the current research, are there gaps where it could be that this is harmful, but that we just don't know about it yet?
Mm-hmm.
And they actually went through and said, for the most part, the research is fairly comprehensive in that on a bunch of these different axes that you could think about, but we've actually looked at and been able to conclusively provide evidence that says this is not harmful. So in my mind, I think at least the nutrition and the health debate, and people argue with this, it seems to be largely settled. What hasn't really been settled are the economic and the environmental impacts. So I remember I was reading somewhere about this new super rice that they'd been created for uses in Southeast Asia and stuff like that, where rice is a primary diet, but they have like massive folate deficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And it was awesome. It provided like vitamins A and D and some of this stuff. But the problem was it took like 3 or 4 times as much water to grow.
Wow, okay.
And rice already takes a ton of water to grow. So it's this additional stuff on top of that that they haven't been able to deal with. So to me, and I don't know because I haven't gone through all the research, but it seems to me that there's still a lot to be discussed on terms of the economic and the environmental impacts of GMOs.
You know, I did my undergrad in ag school, and my bachelor's degree is in bioinformatics, but it was done in the plant sciences department of UC Davis. So I was kind of, they taught me a lot about GMO foods, and even, you know, our stats class was based on agriculture. They had, you know, applied agriculture as the examples. And they kind of brainwashed us in a way, they were very, very insistent that GMO foods are not bad for you. And they kept proving it to us as to why. And I think there are certain foods out there, like bananas, that are completely GMO, and that there is no original banana left in the world. Like, it's just completely engineered by people. But the way they explained it to us was that, you know, you have a natural, say you have, you know, several different types of tomatoes, and then you kind of breed, you crossbreed the ones that are the biggest. And when you do that, over time, you start to get them to naturally make big tomatoes, because you've only bred the big tomatoes with the other big tomatoes. And in that same way, all they're doing now is they're expediting that process. They just kind of get the genomes and go, oh, look, these genes kind of correlate with big tomatoes. So these genes must be the ones involved with making tomatoes big. Let's take these genes and let's put them into a different tomato and make them big genetically. That's all GMO really is. But you know, at the same time, I do agree that they haven't done like a clinical trial on these GMO foods, saying that, you know, proving completely once and for all that they are safe. They've only done, you know, cohort studies or case control studies. And that's okay, though, because I think, you know, when it comes to things like, take smoking, for example. They actually haven't done a clinical trial on smoking. And I think the reason why is because it's unethical to do so. But there's overwhelming evidence that, you know, from cohort studies and case control studies and so on and so forth, that smoking really is bad for you. It really is linked quite heavily to lung cancer. And in that same way, they've done these studies with GMO foods and health, like you just mentioned. And the evidence is overwhelming that they actually are not bad for you.
And that there's a lot that they're beneficial, right? Up until like the 1950s, the world was under food pressure. Like, mm-hmm. They just didn't grow enough food. And then, you know, and this is a simplification, but then along comes Norman Borlaug and, you know, we'll take care of this stuff. And things, you know, things got better, and here we are now. And there's a lot where it's tremendously beneficial. The spoilage thing is really a big thing for me that I get excited about. Or the ability to grow foods in areas that maybe are less hospitable. So there are lots of parts of the world that don't have nearly as much rainfall, or their growing seasons are in such a way that it limits the type of food that they can grow. And the ability to breed plants in a way that can then optimally grow in these conditions, that's tremendously beneficial and tremendously excellent. And so I'm excited about a lot of those potentials. I think where people freak out is the stories of splicing in non-natural genomes. So including things from other, you know, like we do with bacteria, we cross them with all sorts of stuff and from different lines and things, and we create these kind of hybrid things. And people are, you know, freaking out that their corn is going to glow in the dark, right?
Well,
I remember a story of Popular Science a number of years ago where Greenpeace was protesting some of this stuff. And so they went to, this was right when, this was back when I was in high school, so this was as stuff was kind of first coming out or whatever. And they hung this giant banner off of this corn silo with a picture of a corn and a syringe going into it. And it says, this is your food on drugs. And they interviewed Popular Science interviewed the plant manager and said, you know, what do you guys think about this? So, well, you know, we have lots of different thoughts about it, but actually the biggest thing is that's the GMO free, that's the natural silo. The one with the GMO corn is the one next to it.
Well, no one's perfect.
No one's perfect. Definitely not. But yeah, but it's an interesting, it's a hot topic. It's a hot topic debate. It's getting a lot of press and there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of, you know, not less scientifically valid information. So I think the only thing that we could talk about that would be maybe more inflammatory is to talk about vaccines. So yeah, we might have to wait for a couple, let the rage cool off for a little bit.
Well, I think it is a good thing that people are skeptical, because corporate science is kind of a tricky business. So
absolutely ask questions. I think the issue is the confirmation is, you know, confirming bias. And there was a great article, let's see if I can find it, in the BBC the other week about, you know, now that this evidence is coming out, what do we do?
Right.
Do we change what we believe and what we thought, or do we just continue to sit and reconfirm our biases? And it's an interesting question, and it's not one. I mean, you and I will both talk about the limits of science, and there's always some amount of error and some amount of uncertainty. But as the evidence starts to stack up, are we committed to truth and knowledge and science, or are we committed to what we initially thought? Or
right. And there's a word for that. It's called confirmation bias. It's like people kind of joke around that Fox News is like, or and CNN, they're like the kings of confirmation bias, because what they do is they kind of have a point of view and then they look for information and evidence to support that point of view,
yeah,
and ignore everything else.
Yeah.
So they are highly skewed in that way. But I think we've come up on an hour now.
Yep.
So it's time for us to sign off. So yep. Thank you guys for listening to us. And you can follow me on Twitter. You can follow Nick on Twitter as well.
Yep.
Nick, do you have any closing thoughts?
I don't. Stay tuned next time for when we talk about all the things that have been piling up over the last couple weeks that we haven't gotten to, because we've talked about all the other exciting things that we have. So thank you guys for listening. Again, please send us your feedback with any topics you'd like us to discuss, things to steer away from, and any other thoughts you might have. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks, guys.